This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
The survival of disappointment. We all have it in small measures constantly, where we get knocked by disappointments. A person has an expectation, and the expectation is not fulfilled. It happens. Sometimes in more serious areas, sometimes in less serious areas. And these disappointments have infinitely varying effects on different people. And very often you'll find a peculiar person, a person embittered or negative, and somebody will say to you, you've got to understand them, they had a disappointment in life. This happened or that happened, they had a loss, they had a tragedy, whatever. And we tend to accept that. But it's not really right to accept it. Viktor Frankl makes the point that very often the survivors of the camps became embittered people. And there again, one tends to accept it. No? Who can judge a person who went through that hell and blame him for feeling embittered? But Viktor Frankl says the same camps, the same torture and the same suffering made saints out of some people, made tzaddikim out of some people. So is it really fair to blame the camp? The same event has different effects on different people. And we have to learn not to blame events for the way we turn out. We have no control over events. Events happen without us. Events happen despite us. But we do have control on how the events affect us. How we emerge from an event, that we have control of. And that's the discussion, the subject of tonight's shiur, an analysis of the effect of disappointment on people and how to survive major disappointment. Anti-Semitism is founded on two concepts, on two impressions. The one is an inherent hatred of the Jew, about which there's nothing we can do. Halacha Esav Seine is Yaakov. It's a halacha that Esav hates Yaakov. Nothing we can do about that. But there's another reason for anti-Semitism, and that is that very often, unfortunately and tragically, the caricatures of Jews as portrayed by anti-Semites is not inaccurate. I talk about the mean Jew and the moneylender Jew and the this Jew and the that Jew. you look at some of the literature and look, you can virtually see the people they're talking about. We know such people. So that very often the caricatures of anti-Semites are not necessarily unreal and unrealistic. That observation is made by Rebbe Elie Lofjansatzer. That part of the reason for anti-Semitism is that when our Yidden fall from their levels, they fall very low. He says, in the name of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi in the Kuzari, that it is wrong to classify the world into the four species that the world is normally classified. Doimem, that's mineral. Tzomeach is vegetable. Chai is animal. And Medaber is human. Those are the four species into which the world is categorized. Of course, according to the evolutionists, there are only three. We form part of the animal species. But according to sensible people, there are four species. animal and the human being is a separate species. Says Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, there's a fifth species, and that's the Jew. The Jew is not just a type of person, a type of religion, a human being with a different religion. The Jew is a different species. And Rabbi Yehuda Halevi develops the theory. Rabbi Elia says, what happens when a tree ceases to be a tree? It dies. Does it become a doimim? Does it become a mineral? No, it doesn't. It degenerates. It starts rotting. Minerals don't rot. The tree rots after it dies. So that when the vegetable loses its essential quality, it doesn't drop one level. It drops all the way down. And when an animal ceases to be an animal, does it become a vegetable? When an animal dies, does it become a potato? No. When an animal dies, it smells, it deteriorates, it stinks. And the smell of it, the decay of the body of an animal, is far worse than the smell of decay of vegetable. And what about a human being? When he ceases to be a human being, does he become an animal? If a human being loses his humanity, does he drop one level and become an animal? No. When a human being loses his humanity, he drops right to the bottom. And that's why a human body has tumor, it smells even worse than an animal body. Even more disgusting when a human being loses his humanity. And therefore, says Rebellia, when a Jew loses his Yiddishkeit, he doesn't become a goy. He becomes far, far, far worse than any non-Jew. A Jew who's lost his Torah, a Jew who's lost his connection with his source, becomes far worse than a non-Jew. We don't see it so much here because a Jew who loses his Yiddishkeit in a place like South Africa remains a South African. It also has their certain moral standards, their certain ethics that keep him. A Jew in England, he's bound by Christian ethics if he loses his Yiddishkeit. But in the Middle East, where there is no Christian ethic, and forget Christian ethic after all, also has its makoros in the Torah, for a lot of it. Some of it has become distorted, but its yesodos are in the Torah. So the way we see the world, the non-Jewish world today, is not what the non-Jewish world used to look like 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, the non-Jewish world was a world of decadence, was a world of total depravity and degeneracy. There was no morality other than Torah 2,000 years ago. And there are still places in the world where there is no morality apart from Torah. Middle East is one such place. And that's why, tzareinu, tragically, when a Jew in Eretz Yisrael loses his Yiddishkeit, he doesn't just become like a Christian. Like a non-Jew in South Africa or in America or in England or in Europe, he loses everything. He becomes not a non-Jew, not an animal, not a vegetable. Worse, worse, worse. And it's those people that the non-Jewish world often comes into contact with. When the non-Jewish world thinks of a Jew, they don't think of the Chofetz Chaim. They never saw the Chofetz Chaim. When the non-Jewish world think of a Jew, they don't think of the Vilna Gaon. They don't think of the Brisker Rav. They don't think of the Shtaipeler. Who do they think of? The Jew who's lost his Torah. Says Rabbi Elia, what they don't realize is that the reason that Jew who they see is so despicable to them is because of how great the Jewish nation is, not because of how mean the Jewish nation is. It's because of how far this man has fallen that he looks such a mess. Sure, the higher you go, the bigger the drop. And you're looking at a person who's fallen from the heights of humanity. What do you expect him to be? The picture of prettiness? Of course he's ugly and despicable. And if you want to hate him for it, that's fine, you're entitled to. But you've got to see that as a manifestation of the greatness of the Jewish people, not of the baseness of the Jewish people. We have to understand that effect that the fall has on a person. One can fall from such a high level and be so damaged in the process. And the Yesoid is a Yesoid of Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz Zatzal, who gives the most beautiful pshat in an otherwise very difficult Gemara to understand. I've spoken about this several times before. The Gemara is in Chagiga Daf Hei on the Beis. Rebbe, Avanaki Tsefer Kinuitz Bekokari Begadeh. Rebbe on Tisha B'Av used to take a Sefer Kinuitz and he used to read. Kimato Lahai Psuko, when he came to this posuk, Hishlich Mishamayim Eretz, that Hashem has thrown the glory of Yerushalayim, the glory of the Jewish people, from heaven to earth, he's cast it down. Nofal Min Yodeh. The Sefer Kinuitz fell out of his hand. It's mashma from the Gemara that this didn't happen once. It's mashma from the Gemara that used to happen every Tisha B'Av. It says, Ki hava nakit, he used to do this, this is what he used to do, and when he used to get to this posuk, the Sefer Kinuitz fell out. Which shows us something of the freshness with which Rebbe used to learn the Sefer Kinuitz every Tisha B'Av. Again and again he was shocked at this posuk, and the shock always had the effect of him losing the sefer would fall. Omar, and then he would say, "May igro ram lebiro amikta." From such a height, from an exalted height, to such low down depths. That's what he would say. Chaim used to ask, what has this got to do with it? Why does he have to drop the sefer? What does it mean? Says Reb Chaim, he used to look at the Sefer and he used to see that the Sefer was damaged, and he used to realize that the Sefer wasn't damaged because it was on the floor. The Sefer was damaged because it fell, not because it's on the floor. One can be on a low level and not be damaged, but to fall, the fall itself causes the damage. And therefore you could have one Sefer on a table and you could have another Sefer on the floor, and you can drop another sefer from much higher up and let it land higher than the table. So at the end of the day, this is the highest of all. The sefer which you dropped is the highest of all. Yet that's the one that's broken. Why did it break? It's the highest. What's important is not where you are. What's important is that you've fallen, not where you've landed. The fall itself destroys. The fall itself shatters, and the fall itself breaks. Therefore, when you look at a Jew who's lost his Torah, the reason that he looks so despicable is not because he's low down. He's not lower than a goy. That's not the reason. He's not lower than an animal. After all, he's a human being. After all, he's got a Yiddish and a Shomer. You can't say he's lower. So why does he look so awful? Why does he act so awful? Why does he create such a bad impression? Because he's fallen. And when a person has fallen, it's not important where he's landed. What's important is only how far he's fallen. And a Yid who's lost his Torah has fallen ever so far, so far. And that fall shatters him. And that fall breaks him. And that fall makes him look after it so despicable and so unattractive. And we find that concept in various different episodes. Ruth and Orpah, after the loss of their husbands, follow their mother-in-law Naomi back from their land to Eretz Yisrael, and they insist on following her, and she pleads with them to go back. There's no life for them in Eretz Yisrael. There'll be nobody for them to marry in Eretz Yisrael. There'll be no social environment for them in Eretz Yisrael. Naomi is poor, she's got nothing to give them. Why doesn't she go back? They come from important families in their land. They can go back to their land, they'll be looked after, they'll be looked up to, they'll be the center of society, they'll be organized, they'll very soon be married off, their future lies in their land, not in Eretz Yisrael. And they insist, no, their duty lies with Naomi, they're going with her. They follow her and follow her, and Naomi pleads and pleads. At the end of it, Orpah says, okay, I'm going back. The Rus Dovkobo, but Rus cleaves to Naomi. Chazal tell us that that night, after Orpah, who up till that point is classified together with Ruth. All the time that the Tanakh talks about the two of them together, they both perceive their duties the same, they're both prepared to sacrifice their social lives and their entire future in order to be with their mother-in-law and to go back with her to Israel, because in that they see their duty. They both equally perceive the necessity for such Mesirus Nefesh. And then Orpah decides to go home, and that night, hours only after her tremendously high standard that she's achieved, Chazal describe levels of moral decadence and depravity that defy the imagination, to which she sank. How is that possible? Within one night, within one day, within a few hours, she descends from being Naomi's daughter-in-law and equal to Ruth. She descends to depths of such moral decadence within a few hours. How is that possible? Explains that Chaim Shmuel Levitz, that's the effect of disappointment. She was disappointed in herself. She felt rejected. She felt she'd failed. She looked back and she saw Ruth stuck it out. Ruth was willing to stay with the mother-in-law. I couldn't bring myself to do it. Therefore I failed. And now comes the danger, says Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz. Okay, you failed, that means you've fallen. But they tell me in Judah, one of the first things you learn is how to fall without hurting yourself. The first thing you need to know. If you're going to go into a battle and you don't know how to fall, you're going to destroy yourself. And she went into battle not knowing how to shield herself from the fall. And the fall damaged her. Within minutes, it destroyed everything she had. Not just the level she was on. There were other people who weren't on such a level. There were other people who were on much lower levels than her, but they didn't do the kind of things she did that night. How does one understand such a thing? It wasn't the level she was on. It was the fall she had. The fall damaged her. The fall shocked her. She had lost her status. She had lost her meaning. She had lost her sense of being, her sense of purpose. She suddenly felt, what purpose is there to life if I can't even stand up to that kind of nisoya, if I can't stand up to that trial? I left my mother-in-law. Ruth was able to sleep with her, and she gave up. And she allowed herself to sink to absolute depravity within a few hours. That's what the human being can do. There's no guarantee. We think we're on a level, we think we're okay, we think we're fine. One little shake, one little disappointment, and look what can happen. And if one would have seen Orpah that night, in her state of depravity and decadence, and one would have turned to one's friend and said, isn't that Orpah? And he would have said, yes, that's Orpah. And one would have said, but Orpah, she was a daughter-in-law of Naomi, she was on the top of the world, Tzadikus, what's happened to her? Oh, our friend would answer, she had a bad experience. She was rejected, she failed. That's what happened. And we tend to accept that as an excuse. The person had a disappointment. We have it with Cain. Cain was a great man, a son of Odom HaRishon, a person with whom the Ribbono Shel communicated directly. He was a Novi. We can't underestimate the stature of Cain, we dare not. Cain himself worked out the importance of bringing a korban, as the Ramban says. A great lamdan. And he brings his korban, and his korban fails. The Torah tells us that he takes Hevel out into the field. There's a strange posuk. Vayomer Cain el Hevel ochiv. And Cain said to Hevel his brother, and the Torah doesn't tell us what he said. It's the only time that happens in the Torah. It says, and Cain said to his brother, colon. And then it just goes on. And it was when they were in the field, he got up and killed his brother. We're not told at any point what he told his brother. Says the Targum Yonason. Ane Cain v'yomar. Cain answered and he said Lehevel, to Hevel his brother. Listen to this. A great man, the son of Odom HaRishon. Somebody who has had direct communication with the Ribbono Shel Olam. Less din, the less dayon. There is no justice and there is no judge. The less alom achron, and there is no world to come. V'les l'mitn agar tav l'tzadikayo, and there's nobody to reward tzadikim. V'les l'mifro min rishayo, and there's nobody to punish rishoyim. Total kfira. Total denial of the Ribbono Shel Olam. Whereas 5 minutes ago he was a tzaddik. 5 minutes ago he was a novi, he was a prophet. And within 5 minutes he can drop to that level? It's something that can shock a person to realize how low one can fall so fast. We tend to think we're secure. We tend to think that whatever level we're on, we're kind of secure in that level. It's nonsense. We're up and we're down and we're up and we're down. And at any time, chas v'sholem, something can snap and we can drop to such low levels. Unbelievable. Keep with Kayan. How's it possible? Says Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, disappointment. He brought a sacrifice, wasn't accepted. Hevel brought a sacrifice, it was accepted. He couldn't take the disappointment. And so if we were walking along with our friend and we saw Kayin cursing and denying the Ribbono Shel Olam, less din v'less dayon, we would look again and we would say, but isn't that Rabbi Kayin? I'd say, yes, that's Rabbi Kayin. How can he be saying such a thing? The great Rabbi Kayin? The Novi? The prophet? Yeah, he had a bad experience. He had a disappointment in life. Things didn't go well for him. So he suffered. We hear that over and over again. He's like that because he had a divorce. He's like that because he lost a dear one. He's like that because he went through the war. He's like, we always hear this excuse being given for people's inadequacies, for people's bitternesses, for people's negativity. And we see, even great people were destroyed, totally destroyed and devastated by the fall they suffered, by the disappointment, the loss of their status, shattered them totally. I never forget, as a very small child, there used to be a parliamentarian, you might remember, a very well-known Jewish parliamentarian. He was a mayor of Johannesburg for some time too, called Jaime Miller. Very fine person. Remember Jaime Miller? I must be getting on in years. I see that we here are the only ones who remember Jaime Miller. And I remember Jaime Miller once donated a bear to the zoo. And when my father used to take us to the zoo, we always, there's Jaime Miller. He used to say, there was a bear that we used to call Jaime Miller, and we used to take food for him always. I stand Jaime Miller, up Jaime Miller, here's another Jaime Miller. We used to stand there and always shout Jaime Miller. One day I was in the great synagogue with my father, and he introduced me to the real Jaime Miller. He was afraid that I would always think that Jaime Miller was the bear. And there was Jaime Miller himself, so he called. I was a little boy, and he said to me, "This is Jaime Miller." And Jaime Miller said, "No, this was Jaime Miller." And I couldn't understand it, and I said to my father, "What did he mean, this was Jaime Miller?" He'd just lost his last election. He was no longer a member of parliament. And I remember as a child, this devastated man, this crumpled up man, this was Jaime Miller. He lost everything. The effect of loss of status on a person, the destruction. A married man or woman goes through a divorce, complete loss, change. A person loses his money, chas v'sholem, a devastation. A person loses a dear one, a death in the family, a devastation. What it can do to a person can utterly destroy one. And yet, we find people who responded differently. We talked last night about Hogar. Avraham Avinu marries Hogar and they have a child, Yishmael. The Shadchanis is Sora. Sora is the one who suggests the Shidduch. The child grows up, and later on, Sora has a child of her own, Yitzchok. And at a Seudas Mitzvah, which Avraham and Sora made in honor of Yitzchok, Vatere Soros ben Hagar Hamitzris Asher Yoldo Leavrom, and Soros saw the son of Hagar the Mitzris. She saw Yishmael Mitzachek. And we noted last night that Mitzachek doesn't mean he was laughing. Unkulu says Mechayich. He was smiling. Sitting at the Suda's Mitzvah and smiling. What is Soros' reaction? And she says to Avrom, divorce and expel this maid and her son out of the house. It's his son, it's his wife. That's what Sora demands. And Avrom found this very difficult and wrong, because after all it was his son. Don't be worried about the boy and the maid servant. Whatever Soro has told you, you do. Carry it out. You cure up. Correct. What did Hagar do wrong? Nothing is recorded that Hagar did wrong. Nothing at all. Yishmael was smiling at the Suda's mitzvah. That's all. Targum Yonason says not that he was smiling, she saw him doing something worse. She saw that he was megachich lefulchono nuchro begochim l'Hashem. She saw that he used to bow to idolatry and bow to Hashem. Keeping on both sides. That's what she saw. But that's not what it says. It says metzachek. But we have to reconcile Unkelus and Targum Yonason, it's the same. What she saw was a smile on Yishmael, that's all, but a smile is a peculiar expression. A smile is the expression of somebody who thinks that something's funny, but doesn't want anybody else to know that he thinks it's funny. That's what he smiles. If he really thinks it's funny and he wants to share the joke, he laughs. But if he wants to keep the joke to himself, he smiles. She sees him at the Suda's mitzvah, not laughing, not happy. She sees him with a cynical smile on his face. That means he's mocking it. Why is he mocking it? Because he holds by idolatry still. If he holds by idolatry, why doesn't he laugh at it? Why doesn't he mock and jeer openly? Why does he sit at the table? Because he says Hashem as well. Both. He doesn't want, when he's with the Jews, when he's with Avraham's family, he wants people to think he's a good Jew. When he's with the Ovdei Avodah Zarah, with the idol worshippers, he'll be a good idol worshipper. And so there was an unavoidable, faint flicker of a smile, that cynical smile of, isn't this all a lot of nonsense? Just a faint, nobody else noticed it, as we said last night. Avram didn't notice it. Yitzhak didn't notice it. He was a baby. The guests didn't notice it. Only Sora with her Ruach HaKodesh was able to notice. That faint, faint flicker of a cynical smile. And she says, that we can't have. A smile! That means cynicism. That means he's laughing at us, but he won't. He's not willing to really laugh at us. That means it's all beneath the surface. Who knows what else is beneath the surface? And where does that come from? Surely his mother should have brought him up differently in the home of Avraham Avinu? There must be something wrong with the mother too. There must be an idolatrous tendency in the mother if the child can sit at the Suda's mitzvah with a smirk on his face. And later on we see that she was right. Because when it says, Vatelech, Vateso, Bemidbar Be'eshova, and she went and she wandered in the deserts of Be'eshova, says Rashi, who brings the Medrash, not that she wandered physically, she went, she found a home. But Chozro Ligilule Besavio, she wandered back to the idolatry of her father's house. And therefore we see that Sora in retrospect was absolutely correct. She wandered back to her father's house, to the idolatry of her father's house. Sora was able to perceive that tendency in Hagar by the way her son behaved. Not by the way she behaved. You couldn't pick it out on her. But it expressed itself in Yishmael's behavior. A touch of idolatrous cynicism, and she rejects them. What should have been Sora's response to that? I'll get them one day. I'll get them back. Depravity should have been the response. Good, if that's what it is, if that's what Torah is all about, if I've got no place in it, fine, I want nothing more to do with it. As she does, off she goes to idolatry. The fall that we've been talking about, how she must have fallen from being the wife of Avraham Avinu to being a wandering nomad in the desert, having a son who was to be an heir of Avraham Avinu, in her mind at least, having been expelled from the home. What does one expect? Surely total falling, total disappointment, total devastation and sense of loss. Surely had we introduced our children to her and said, this is Hagar, she would have said, no, this was Hagar. Surely that's how she would have responded. Total loss, like an Orpah, like a Cain. Less din, less dayan, there is no God, I don't believe in a God. That's the response we would have expected of her. And we would have, if we would have asked our friend, surely that's the Hagar, the ex-wife of Avraham, what's happened to her? And our friend would say, yes, she had a bad experience, she was rejected, she was disappointed, she lost her status. She was kicked out of Avraham Avinu's house, expelled. What a terrible thing it is. Being expelled from a job, being fired. What, at the end of the world, it's an economic transaction. Same as you're employed, you're expelled. Nothing serious, but it devastates people. Because with it comes a loss of status. When a man goes home having been fired, he's not just a person who is no longer employed in a particular place. He now becomes an unemployed. It's a different person. It's a person without status. That's why the headhunters always tell people, go for job interviews before you lose your job. Once you've lost your job, you don't come over the same. A different human being once you've lost your job. Different Matthias. You're an unemployed person. You've lost your status, you're devastated, and you come over insecure and devastated and shocked. Nobody wants to employ such a person. A person gets expelled from a school, from a university. Terrible thing. A person gets expelled from a country. Terrible thing. A person gets expelled from the home of Avraham Avinu. What a stigma to go about with for the rest of your life. Ah, you were the one who was kicked out of Avraham Avinu's home. Ah, yeah, I remember hearing about it. That becomes who are you? The one who was kicked out of Avraham Avinu's home. That is such a terrible stigma. One would expect that total devastation to have destroyed her utterly and her son. And yet she reappears in this week's Sedra. In what status does she reappear in this week's Sedra? All of a sudden, back she comes. As we said last night, changed identity, new passport, new name, new photograph. Keturah she's called. And how does she come back? As Avraham's new wife. What happened? Would Avraham have married her after that? Yes, says Rashi. Her name was changed. Zu Hagar v'nikres Keturah Hashem Shinoi Ma'aseho Keturis. Her deeds were now as good as the Keturis, as the incense offering. She had done tshuva, as the Klei Yoko learns in Rashi. This wasn't the same Hagar anymore. This is Keturah, a new person. She'd taken on the challenge. Her rejection was not an excuse for depravity. Her rejection was not a one-way ticket to the bottoms of human existence. Her rejection was not a reason for losing her sense of balance. She pulled herself together. She pulled herself up. She sorted herself out and got herself back to better than she was before the rejection. That's how it affected her. So we see that disappointment doesn't necessarily have to devastate a person. As Viktor Frankl observed, there are some people who are made tzaddikim by devastation, and there are some people who are made rishoyim by devastation. It has different effects on different people, which means you can't blame the event. The same event can make a saint out of one person and a rotter out of the other. Can't blame the event. It's the person who is affected in the way he chooses to be affected. Can't blame the event. So what we now have to do, having noted this concept, that there is this difference, and that events have different effects on different people, same events can have different effects on different people, we need to try and understand what was Helga's secret. How did she manage to survive that which Cain couldn't survive? How did she manage to survive that which Orpah could not survive? How does she manage to come out of rejection with an enhanced spiritual being? How does she do it? What is her secret recipe to be able to endure disappointment and rejection and expulsion, and not only endure it and survive it, but thrive on it? How does she do it? Because if we can find that answer, if we can find that, how we could be able to help ourselves and to help other people cope with disappointment, cope with rejection, cope with loss. The key to that must be in her name. Her new name is Keturah. And Rashi says her deeds are now like the Keturis. That's why she was called Keturah. The Torah must be giving us the key here as to how to cope with disappointment. In the word Keturah lies the solution, lies the direction to how to cope with disappointment. Where do we go from here? What does Keturah mean? Keturis, incense offering. What is an offering? What is a korban? A korban is, you take an animal and you slaughter it, you shecht it, and the blood is received and thrown on the mizbeach, the altar. The carcass of the animal is carved up, is brought on the mizbeach. Sometimes parts of it are eaten, sometimes parts of it aren't eaten. What's it all about? How can you make an animal smell good? Go to a farm, smell the animal straight away. Go to an abattoir, you smell the animal straight away. What can you do to make an animal smell good? So some people think you've got to make dog parlors, and you can perfume them, and you can groom them, wash them, and they'll smell good. But they don't. They don't smell good at all. You know, sometimes a perfume can give a nice smell, but sometimes a perfume you smell the perfume, but you smell the bad smell at the same time. It doesn't do anything. And I perfume a dog, even if it's a poodle, it doesn't have any effect. It still smells awful. How can you make an animal smell nice? There's only one way. You have to shecht it and clean it, salt it and soak it, and grill it. And it smells nice. Ah, and the geschmack, you come to a braai, all of a sudden an animal smells good. That's the only way you can make an animal smell good. There is no other way. If you want to enjoy the smell of an animal, there's only one place you'll enjoy it, and that's on the braai. That's the metzius. We like it or not, and what the conservationists will say about such a thing, I don't know and I don't care, but that's the metzius. There is no other way. That's a korban. To understand that the only way you're going to make the animal inside you smell good is to master it. To slaughter it if necessary. To carve it up if necessary. And to burn it up if necessary. If you're prepared to live with Mesiras Nefesh, if you're prepared to master your body to the extent and your passions, to the extent that you're prepared to kill them if necessary, and burn them up, then you can get the smell. Then the body can smell nice. Then even the physical things in life can have a geschmack. They can be good. But if you're not, if you want to keep the animal alive, if you want to groom the animal, and wash the animal, and massage the animal, and perfume the animal, it doesn't work. An animal blights an animal. There's nothing you can do with it until you're willing to shecht it. Shecht it and grill it, and it starts smelling good. The more you work the animal in the human being, the more you slaughter it, not physically, but metaphorically, The more you kill it, the more you murder it, the more you work it, the more you discipline it, the better it smells. When you burn it up with spiritual energy, it smells good, so good. That's what the korban is for. To understand that the reach nichoyach, the Ribbono Shel Olam enjoys the smell of burning meat. Why? God enjoys the smell of burning meat? Yes. Because that means something to him. That's the smell of a person willing to burn his own meat. Burn it up in the cause of Avodas Hashem. And that smells good to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's what it means, that peculiar phrase in the Chumash, Reach Nichoyach, a delightful smell to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But the Mesillas Yesharim, which we learnt last Sunday, says that there are two levels of human being, of great human beings. There's the level of the Tohir and the level of the Kodesh. Tohir is a pure person, and the Kodesh is a holy person. What's the difference between them, explains the Mesillas Yesharim? The Tohir is one who has burnt up all his physicality. There is nothing, he only does that which is absolutely necessary physically. He only eats as much as he needs to eat in order to survive. He only sleeps as much as he needs to sleep in order to survive. Whatever physical and material he does only for the purpose of Avodas Hashem. That's a reach nichoyach laHashem. He's burnt up his physicality, he's mastered it, he's chopped it up, he's subjected it to himself, and to his will and to the desire of the Ribbono Shel Olam. And there's nothing, there's no motivation, there's no ambition which he allows to have any force whatever, except if it's for the Ribbono Shel Olam. He has burnt his materialism. He's brought himself as a korban, he's brought himself as a sacrifice, and he smells good. That, says the Mesillas Yesharim, there's a level even greater. There's the kind of person who doesn't have to kill his material being, who doesn't have to destroy it and wipe it out, and he does it only for the purpose of Hashem. There is the person who is able to spiritualize his physicality. He's actually able to elevate it that it ceases to be physical. That when he eats, it's a spiritual act, it has nothing physical to it. That when he sleeps, it's a spiritual act, it has nothing physical with it. That his whole body is spiritualized. The ultimate achievement, says the Mesillas Yesharim, the achievement of Kedusha, which taken to its absolute level, is the level that Eliyahu HaNavi reached, where he never even died. Death is the final murdering of the body. That's now killed and the neshama is released. But Eliyahu HaNavi spiritualized his body. He didn't kill it. It stayed with him in a spiritual form. That's an even higher level. And that, says the Mesillas Yesharim, is the level of Kedusha. Where does that fit into korbanos then? Where does that fit into sacrifices? What sacrifice have we got that embodies the picture of smell, of delicious smell, without having to roast the flesh? Where you've got only the spirit and you don't have to roast the flesh. It's one korban, one sacrifice that used to be brought on the golden altar. The korban haktoiris, the korban of spices. Spices, when those spices were brought, what a delicious smell they had. No animal was slaughtered, no blood was thrown, no animal was chopped up, no animal was grilled. It was possible on that occasion, when the Ketores was brought, only on Yom Kippur, inside, right inside the Kodshei HaKadoshim, there on that most holy of days, on that most holy of places, brought by the most holy of people, the Kohen Gadol himself, it was possible to reach a kind of a korban where we could give Hashem Yisborach the pleasure of the smell without killing the animal. So even a higher level, totally spiritualized, nothing physical at all. The ordinary korban was brought, it was physical, but it was the destruction of the physical which created the smell. The Ketores created the smell without the destruction of the physical. The physical was elevated. It's a beautiful tanchuma at the end of Tetzaveh. On the question of korbanos, asks the Tanchuma, "V'im toimar yesh lefonai achila u'shtiyah?" And if you will ask, what does God need sacrifices for? Does he eat? Does he drink? Does he enjoy this kind of thing? Elo mikol korbanoseim ein yiretze elo hareach, says the Tanchuma. All I want from the korban is the smell. Strange, Tanchuma, does the Ribbono Shel Olam enjoy the smell? Yes. Smell is the most spiritual of the senses, in fact the only spiritual sense. Smell is considered. That's why on Motzei Shabbos, in order to relieve the pain of the Neshomo Yaseira, we smell Besomim. Smell is the only physical sense which bridges the gap between the physical and the spiritual. And through a physical sense allows the spiritual to have immediate pleasure. And there's a chidush in this Tanchuma, that even the Ribbono Shel Olam enjoys the smell. We're not willing to simplify godliness. We're not willing to concretize and materialize godliness. We're leaving the Ribbono Shel Olam where he is. And we yet have a tzivui, we have an instruction to know the Ribbono Shel Olam, to believe in the Ribbono Shel Olam, to relate to the Ribbono Shel Olam, to understand the Ribbono Shel Olam. And who is that instruction given to? To the Chofetz Chaim? To Moshe Rabbeinu? Who is that instruction given to? To every single Jew. 13 years old and upwards, the Jew is capable of elevating himself. If he will master his physical, if he will master his material, just as you can take an animal and you can make an animal smell good, but you've got to be prepared to kill the animal to make it smell good. So a human being can grasp godliness. If he's willing to kill the animal, he can grasp godliness. And ultimately, after he's passed the level of being willing to kill the animal, he can get to the level of the Ktoiris, to the level of the Kodesh, where he can elevate the animal, not kill it, and spiritualize it totally. That there's a merging of physical and spiritual. That's what he's capable of being able to do as well, ultimately. That's how great the human being is. A greatness which the Torah recognizes, and which the Ribbono Shel Olam demands from us. Hagar left the home of Avraham Avinu, and she went to serve idolatry. And then she pulled herself together. And she got to what level? To the level of a Ketores. To the level not only of the Mesilas Yeshorim's Tohir. She went beyond that. She got to the level of the Mesilas Yeshorim's Kodosh. She got to the level of the Ketores. She ma'aseh noim k'Ketores. Her deeds were as beautiful, not as an oila, and not as a chatos, or an oshom, or a tomid. Her deeds were as beautiful as a Ketores. That means she reached the highest levels of human achievement. At that point, Avraham takes her back and marries her. That's Keturah. That's Hagar after her fall. How great she becomes. How she's able to pull herself together and realize, after she drops briefly to the depths of Avodah Zarah, suddenly she realizes, this is nonsense. Taking God and simplifying him? That's not what I'm used to in the home of Avraham Avinu. I'm used to the human being elevating himself to God. And she starts to work on herself and build herself up and up and up until she reaches it. Very often you get people. I met a person the other day, a relation of mine. Because he goes to shul, he doesn't understand the word. Wasn't brought up being able to read. Can't read Hebrew, doesn't understand, doesn't even understand the droshes of the Rav, he doesn't understand anything. The choir, the chazan, the choir he enjoys a little bit, but that's all. But he goes to shul every Shabbos, every Friday night, every Shabbos. And he says people ask him why he doesn't go to Reform. And he doesn't know how to answer them. But he says, he can't go to Reform. But they say, but at Reform you understand everything. They explain everything nicely, it's all in English, but no difficulty. He says, I don't know why, but I can't. The answer is, there's a little bit of this inside him. He understands the solution is not to bring God down. That's not Yiddishkeit. But he Ribbono Shel Olam must stay where he is. Even if I can't get anywhere near him, I dare not bring him down. Because once I bring him down, even if I feel I'm getting closer that way, I'm getting closer to a lie. I'm getting closer to falsehood, because the Ribbono Shel Olam can't be brought down to these levels. That's not God anymore. At least this way, I sit on the floor and the Ribbono Shel Olam's up there in heaven, and I don't understand him, and I can't relate to him, and I don't understand anything that's going on in shul, and I don't understand the Rav's drosha, and I don't understand the Shema and the Shmoneh Esrei, so I don't know what I'm doing. But one thing I know, that God up there that I don't understand, he's the real God.
As I know. Occurring to a reformed temple? You understand everything. The only trouble is what you're understanding has nothing to do with the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's not God, but you understand it all. That's the difference. And how careful we have to be not to pander to people's desires to feel comfortable with God and to bring God down in order to make them feel comfortable. Rather feel uncomfortable. But you're feeling uncomfortable with the real Ribbono Shel Olam. The same with the Torah. We have to be terribly careful not to make childish stories and superficial involvement with the Torah. The Torah stays the same Torah. It's the Torah of Abai and Rove. It's the Torah of the Vilna Gaon. It's the Torah of Rabbi Kiva Eger. It's the Torah of the Noida Yehuda. That's our Torah. It's hard. It's difficult. We don't understand the sugya. We tear our hair out with aggravation and frustration. But at least I know one thing. This piece of Gemara which I don't understand, it's the real Gemara that I don't understand. The moment we start making nonsense out of it and making it superficial and going through it quickly and easily and this is what it means, and it's all very nice, feels good. I understand it all. But it's not the Torah. What I understand is not real. How careful we have to be to see that people are relating to MS. Rather be distant than be distant from MS than be close and be close to Sheker, be close to a lie. I spoke in the ladies' shul this afternoon of how careful one has to be with Hanifa, with flattery. And the ladies asked me, but aren't you allowed to flatter people in order to make them feel comfortable? And then they'll come to shul and they'll come to shiurim because you're flattering them. And eventually it'll be okay. Eventually they'll start enjoying it. And then you can stop flattering. And then, mitot shilo lishmo bo lishmo, starts off for the wrong reasons, but afterwards it comes for a reason. Make a fuss of them, show them honor, make them sit up at the top, give them warm shalom aleichem, invite them home for lunch and for dinner, make a big fuss of them. And they'll stay. The answer is no. You can't start with sheker. You can't bring a person to MS. You can't bring a person to truth through the corridors of sheker, through the corridors of falsehood. Because falsehood doesn't lead to truth. You can walk down the corridors for as long as you want, but if those corridors are based on sheker, then they will lead nowhere. They will not lead to truth. Rabbeinu Bechaya gives four reasons why chanifus, why flattery is worse than idolatry. Four reasons. And we would never think that you would be permitted to serve idolatry in order to bring more people to Yiddishkeit. Let me serve idolatry just once or twice, and I'll be able to bring thousands of young lost Jewish souls back to Yiddishkeit. The answer is no, you can't do it. If I can't serve idolatry, how much more so am I not permitted to flatter people in order to bring them to Yiddishkeit? If the only way they're going to come to Yiddishkeit is through flattery and honor and all sorts of false things, then better not involve in Yiddishkeit. Rather be distant from the real God and from the real Torah than be close to a lie, to be close to something which isn't real. Very often people come into Torah for the wrong reasons. They're made to feel so comfortable and they're entertained so joyously. But that's why they come. And they feel so good and they tell you how holy they're feeling. And years later they go through a depression. Now people aren't making quite such a fuss of them anymore. And nobody's really making an effort to entertain them so much anymore. Now it comes to the hard grind. You've got to start learning Torah. This they didn't bargain for. All of a sudden they realize that what they have felt close to all the years hasn't been Torah. It's been entertainment. It hasn't been Torah. One can't bring people to Emes through the corridors of sheker. This Keturah, she manages to survive the disappointment. How does she do it? She reaches the level of Kedusha. What's the key? The Gemara at the end of Menachos says, Omar Rabbi Yochanan, Elu Talmidei Chachomim Sheloimdim Torah B'chol Mokom. These are Talmidei Chachomim who learn Torah in all places. Ma'ale Ani Aleim Ki'ilu Maktirim L'fonai. I consider them as if they're bringing a Korban K'toiris before me. Strange Gemara. Haktoris, the Kohen Gadol, used to bring once a year, only when the Beis HaMikdash was there, once a year used to bring the Korban Haktoris in the Kodesh HaKadosh. Says the Gemara in Menachos, the Talmidei Chachomim that learn Torah in all places, the Ribbono Shel Olam considers it as if they're bringing a Ketores, the same concept. Just as there are two kinds of human beings and there are two kinds of sacrifices, the one sacrifice has an animal and makes a pleasant smell, and the other sacrifice is pure smell, no animal. And so we said there are two kinds of human beings. The one has a physical being, but the physical being is subservient, it's been slaughtered and it serves the Ribbono Shel Olam, and the other human being, the Kodesh, doesn't even have a physical being. It's all spiritual. So in the realm of mitzvahs, there are two kinds of mitzvahs. Some mitzvahs have a physical part to them, but by using the physical part for the mitzvah, it all becomes elevated. And some mitzvahs have no physical part at all. The tefillin is made from leather. Shabbos, you make kiddush on wine. All these mitzvahs have physical things to them. Torah has nothing physical. The mitzvah of learning Torah is the Korban Ketores. No animal in it, there's nothing physical in it, it's pure spirituality, pure ruchnius, nothing else. Says the Gemara, these are the Talmidei Chachomim who are learning Torah b'chol mokum. What does that mean, b'chol mokum? A mitzvah is a funny thing, because a mitzvah is defined, and you can only do a particular mitzvah at a particular time in a particular way. You can't shake your lulav on Pesach, doesn't work, doesn't help. You can't eat matzah on Purim. Each mitzvah has its time. Shabbos has its time, and Shacharis has its time, and Mincha has its time, and Pesach has its time, and each mitzvah has its own particular time and its own particular rules which govern. And if you try and perform the mitzvah outside of those governing rules, the mitzvah is invalid. Not so Torah. Torah you can learn any time of the day or night in virtually any place. Doesn't matter. You don't need to have it with you. Tefillin, you've got to have your tefillin with you. You don't have your tefillin with you, you can't put your tefillin on. Your lulav and esrog, not only do you need the time, but you need the object. If you don't have the object, you can't be mekayim the mitzvah. Torah is not so. Wherever you are, you just sit down and start analyzing, thinking Torah, going through something you've learned recently, something you heard, thinking on it, deepening your understanding of it. You don't need a sefer, you don't need an object, you don't need a particular time, you don't need a particular place. That's the segula of Torah. It is not governed by time and place. And that is the most perfect mechanism that the Jew uses to retain his sanity. Like any Jew who's traveled knows what it's like. You travel to a different continent where the people are different, the language is different, the food is different, the society is different. One feels so foreign and out of depth. Come to your hotel in the evening after a day's business and you open your Gemara and you carry on from where you left off yesterday. And where were you yesterday? Sitting in your Beis HaMedrash at home in Johannesburg. And now you're in Timbuktu and you're just carrying on with the same Gemara. On and on. You bump into another Jew, you find he's also learning Gemara, you've immediately got something to talk about. You come home 6 weeks later and you carry on and you find everybody else is in the same place, nothing's changed. Stability. Torah is able to guarantee a stability. One's thinking doesn't change, one's value system doesn't change, but it goes one step further. A person who's learning, or perhaps I'm going to use a wider term, thinking, as we said at the Shalosh Shudas today, a person who's a deep thinker and who thinks in a Torah-dika way and who thinks in Torah, his whole fulfillment is from the way he thinks, from the way he learns. His sense of status is also from that. That when he comments, people listen. Why do they listen? Because there's depth to it. They like to listen. He's got something to say. When there's a difficult issue, they consult with him. Why? Not because he occupies a position. Because he's a deep thinker, because he's a Torah Dikker Jew, he thinks straight. When an individual needs a bit of advice, they come and consult with him. Why? Not because he occupies an office. Because he has a straight thinking, a Talmid Chacham. He knows how to think, he knows how to analyze a situation. And he takes that absolutely wherever he goes. Makes no difference. The moment he opens his mouth, whether it's in Johannesburg, or in New York, or in Yerushalayim, or in Timbuktu, it's amkus, it's deck, it's real, it's straight, and it's immediately recognized and appreciated. Can that be taken away from him? So they'll fire him from his job. What difference does it make? Does that make him a more superficial being?
His status was never dependent on his job. His status was always dependent on his learning. I can understand that, Rabbi Kivaiger. What do I care about the job? The job's a way of earning a living. If he's expelled from his office, so what? What does that mean? Is that status? Status is to be able to analyze a sugi of Gemara and to be able to pass kuma halacha. That status, nobody can take that away. And so the learning of Torah, or the thinking in a Torahdika way, is the Keturah. That's what Keturah had. She was able to survive rejection. She was able to survive expulsion because her status didn't come from her position in Avraham Avinu's heart. Her status came from the way she thought, from the way she analyzed. Cain must have asked when his sacrifice was not accepted. He must have asked, why wasn't it accepted? But he wasn't asking in a Torahdik way. A Torahdik way of asking is, the Ribbono Shel Olam hasn't accepted my korban. Hatzur Tomim Poloi. The Ribbono Shel Olam is perfect in whatever he does. Let me try and understand why not. That's Torah. And it makes no difference what you're analyzing in that way. It's still Torah. Person loses all his money on the stock exchange. He says, why? Why did it have to happen to me? The fellow next door sold the day before it collapsed. Why me? And one thinks, oh, Torahdik Yid, he's asking why. It depends. There's a big difference. If he starts his question, if he precedes the question with the answer, if he says, Hatzur Tomim Poloi, everything the Ribbono Shel Olam does is good and is right, now let me figure out why, then it's Torah. But if he starts with the why and tries to get to the answer, that's not Torah, that's Kefira. That's why we start in Ein Kelukeinu always. We start first Ein Kelukeinu, we give the answer first, and in the next line Mi Kelukeinu, we ask who's like Hashem. Why isn't it the other way around? First, we should first say who is like Hashem, and then we should answer, there's none like Hashem. You start off, there's none like Hashem. Now you can ask whatever question you want. That's Torah, that's thinking. You start off with the MS. Once you know the MS, you question the MS. That's Torah. That's not secular reasoning. And you can have a Torahdika approach to a secular subject, and you can have a secular approach to a Torah subject. You can learn Gemara in university, and it's not Torah. And you can analyze the stock exchange, and it is Torah. It depends how one does it. If you start with the answer of Ein Kelukeinu, of Hatzur Tomim Poloi, of a Tziduk Hadin, then whatever you question after that is all Torah. And one can survive anything if one starts with the answer. Cain didn't start with the answer. He started with a question, and he landed up with Kefira. Orpah didn't start with the answer. She started with a question, and she landed with Kefira. Hagar started with the answer. Avraham Avinu is right, and I don't like it, and it's not pleasant for me to face the facts. Avraham Avinu is right. Let me figure out now, why did he expel me? Now you can ask why. And if you ask why after you've answered the question, you'll reach the right answer. If you ask why after you've confronted the issue, you'll grow out of it. And there we have the key to the survival of rejection, to the survival of disappointment. Elu Talmidei Chachomim, Ha'uskim b'Torah b'chol makom. These are Talmidei Chachomim who, wherever they are, they're learning Torah. Whether they're depressed or they're happy, they're learning Torah. Whether they're dejected and disappointed or they're elated, they're learning Torah. Whether they're in Johannesburg or in Yerushalayim or they're in Tzvakupmund, they're learning Torah. It makes no difference. The Torah goes on. Elu Talmidei Chachomim. And with that they retain their stability, whatever happens in life. They start with the Ein Kelukeinu. And with that you can tolerate anything. And survive it, and not only survive it, but as we see with Hagar, it is within the human capability not only not to fall as a result of severe disappointment and rejection, not only to survive severe disappointment and rejection, but it's possible even if one clings to Torah, to thinking, to analyzing in a Torahdika way, it is possible for the human being even to thrive on rejection.